This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. When Poi Chen Li left China for the United States in 1948 with her new husband, she made 8 promises to her mother. The 8th promise was to live with compassion toward all. On the program today, we're going to talk with Poi Chen Li's son, William Poi Li, about the mother-son bond, becoming an American, what makes home home, and the exploration of one's ancestral past. William Poi Li is the author of The 8th Promise, an American son's tribute to his Toisanese mother. The book is a memoir. It is a memoir that also contains the voice of Poi Chen. The chapters alternate between mother and son. The chapters that are Poi Chen's are translations of audio recordings made by her son, our guest. William Poi Li was born in San Francisco in 1951, a lawyer since 1979. He earned his undergraduate degree in architecture at the University of California, Berkeley, and his law degree from Hastings College of Law at UC San Francisco. The 8th Promise, an American Son tribute to his Toisanese mother, is William Poi Li's first book. The publisher is Rodale. You'll find our guest, William Poi Li, on the web at www.the8thpromise.com. William Poi Li, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
You open the book by telling readers of your first trip to China. How was it that you decided to make that trip?
Actually, I was making what I considered a grand tour of China, which was, of course, the Great Wall, the Terracotta Warriors, climbing one of the holy mountains, actually two of them, a Buddhist one and a Taoist one. And sort of as a tail end kind of thing, my mother said, well, maybe you should go visit the village. And I sort of said, yeah, okay, Ma. And, you know, and as I was going through China, I was going, geez, you know, there's just millions of villages. Why on earth would I want to go through my village? It's mm-hmm. just, and there were all these rumors that when American-born came back, we'd get fleece for refrigerators, TVs, monies, and 1,000 propositions to marry some local girl and bring her to the United States. So it was all quite daunting, but somehow I decided to go, to get there, it wasn't exactly like Heart of Darkness, but it was quite a travail. We had to drive through some pretty rough country. We had to take 3 ferry boats, and we're not talking about nice ones, but ones where people bring on chickens and tractors and are open. And eventually we got to the village of Hoisin, and I met up with my, I guess she would be my step-aunt. She was adopted by my mom's people after her family was killed by the Japanese and raised by them. And that's how I got to the village. She took me the next day, and I walked past the biggest outhouse in China that I had ever seen. And I just went, boy, we are really backcountry right now. But as I started walking in, I noticed how beautiful the place was. It was almost like a pointillist painting, the fields, the red earth levees. And eventually I walked into what was sort of a village square, and people were just sitting around on their haunches. The chickens and ducks were running around, and the kids were there, and everyone was just in quiet reverie. And Cao Wen, my step-aunt, said, oh, this is Poi Jam, the son of Poi Chen. Now, these people had not expected me to show up. They hadn't heard or seen from my mother for many, many years. But this old man looked at me, took one look at me, and said, yes, you look like her. Welcome home. Mm. And at that moment, my skin just started bubbling like champagne bubbles. Some energy just shot up my spine. And I just started giggling and laughing, and it was the most amazing experience. I describe this as being on the land that is the tuning fork of my spirit, of my soul, if you will, of my kin, and that it's only when you go back to a place where maybe your people have been, in our case, for 1,000 years, that you really feel this resonance between who you are as a biological being and the actual earth that you're standing on.
Oh, so that trip was well worth the effort.
You say
it was the most meaningful and richest part.
Absolutely. It was greater than the Great Wall. It was more beautiful than, you know, any of the National Palace art. It was a higher spiritual hit than even the holy mountains of Buddhism and Taoism.
Yeah. And the year was 1983.
That's correct.
And I want you to talk about here about what your life was like back in the U.S. You call the 80s the brain sweat decade.
Yes. Actually, I had been working for Bank of America from about 1979 to about 1986. I was an international lawyer and a banker. And surprisingly, a lot of what made me very effective was my multicultural background, as well as a way of being with people that my mother had essentially transmitted to me just by being who she is, which is really to try to find the common good and to work out problems for the future, and not to treat somebody as bad just because they messed up on a loan or informally borrowed some money from some traveler's checks you might have left with them, and to really work with them. And those are really the skills, when I look back at it, that really helped me achieve as an international banker and lawyer what a lot of my colleagues could not. But what was happening, I was on that verve. I was a professional. I was an attorney. I went out on my own. I was in litigation. I was making money. Didn't like litigation, and later I found out why, because I wasn't raised to fight. I was raised to work things out. Got into another business with a close friend of mine, advertising. We were doing really, really well. We had a bunch of brand name clients who were a boutique agency, you know, people like Coca-Cola and even Bank of America at one point, and Sprint and Chivas Regal. And then at some point, I paused. I just stopped, and I realized that this wasn't really who I was. And I that resulted in a breach with my partner. And then I took some time off, and I rethought everything. Yeah. And eventually, I was doing some work for Silicon Valley. There was so much going on that I was a subcontractor just picking up pieces of work here and there. And these stories started coming out of me. They literally would just show up on the computer. The first two did anyway. And I read them, and I said, that's not bad. And then I said, well, maybe that's what's happening. Maybe what you're being called to do is do some writing. And so in the next two or three years, about 30 vignettes came out. I had joined a writing group, and I would read them, and people really liked them. And at one point, I organized all the vignettes, kind of like you would a pieces of a puzzle, where you've got a 10,000-piece puzzle, and you kind of put the things that look like trees on this side and the things that look like the house in the middle. And I started to see some narrative threads. I talked to a few friends, and they said, you know, this is what you should concentrate on. This might be really interesting. And that really was the birth of The Eighth Promise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this journey that began, I think, in 1983 in some ways.
Yes.
Or was a pivotal moment in your life. That was a physical journey.
I didn't. It was an emotional realization. I think quite often as Americans, certainly I did. I had a conceit that I was just dropped out of the sky one day in America, and it was my gig just to, you know, pick up the English language, go to college, and become one of the players in American culture, which is essentially to do well monetarily and acquire a certain amount of fame and fortune and, you know, raise kids and do all that. And that is my life gig. But when I went back there, I really got a sense that life is much richer and deeper than I had realized. And I'm not saying this to criticize our lifestyle, but I had a personal realization that there's a lot going on in life, and I'm just on one very important band of it, but that's not the only band.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing of it is that life gig begins to be a checklist.
Yes.
And you're not, it's like, okay, check, check,
right,
check. And rather than, you know, taking some time out to do some soul searching.
Yes. Or you know, I think the expression in America is, you know, smelling the roses. What I did when I took that break was I happened to live in a very beautiful part of the country, which is San Francisco, and I spent a lot of time walking along the waterfront of the Marina Green and bicycling on many of the paths, and I met a lot of kindred spirits, people who also had kind of went on the race as I did, and we're now stepping back. We didn't eschew everything we did, because certainly we just converted our skills into perhaps a more balanced lifestyle. We were still doing the same work, only we were doing it more as subcontractors. We were spending more time doing volunteer work or pursuing interests and hobbies that were truly spoke to our hearts, and in some cases, some of us, like I did, moved into it full time.
Yeah. Well, in the book, in the outset, in the introduction, you say, I would suggest making this kind of internal journey to all Americans.
Yes.
It may well reward us with a level of wholeness and happiness.
Yes. I see that all of us came from somewhere else, and in the process of the American melting pot, and my book talks about how that was happening to me, we feel that it's necessary to drop all that somewhere else and just become whatever is defined as American. And frankly, I can't find a single clear and inarguable definition of this at this point. But I would encourage people, if you can trace back through grandparents, great-grandparents, to whatever village that you may have come from, and many of us were poor immigrants way back in the day, and if you can still go back there and find relatives or stand on land that may have been your family's land for 100 years, 300 years, or more, I think there's a reward there. And I think there's a feeling that you will get about who you are and perhaps an aspect of the meaning of life.
Mm. And writing has been so important in your internal journey. I think that might be useful for us as well, even though we might not do it as well as you do.
Well, it took me 3 years to just do this version of what I was working on. So, yes, it's definitely a dedication and commitment. But I agree with you. I think that, you know, just writing your thoughts and your feelings for yourself as a journal or as a reflection is really good. And if you have parents who are from the old country, or even if they're not, I found remarkable things about my mother. I had started this book as my book, and I was just interviewing her for some background to flesh out a few details I may not have known about. But as she talked about the Klan sisterhood and their intrinsic role in society, of the chi soups that help to adjust the energy body and the for children between seasons so they won't catch cold as easily. And specifically when she really talked about them in terms of the postpartum recovery of women, there's this 30-day isolation in the village where women and their baby are kept in a room, visited only really by the mother and a few women. And they very carefully make specific soups. The first week's soup is to clear out whatever still needs to be cleared out of the body. The second week, they start making a soup that produces sweet, nutritious milk for the baby. And then every week, there's a new soup that has to do with rebuilding the tattered auric body, if you will, the energy body, and to rebuild the chi fires internally, because labor and bringing a baby to full term really takes a lot out of a woman. And I read this, and it was almost like scientific. So I just went, I can't say this is my knowledge. It isn't. And when I looked at models of writing where I could really bring her voice fully forward, it was books like The Color of Water by James McBride, and also In My Mother's House by Kim Chernin. I happen to know Kim Chernin, so when I did a number of chapters in my mother's voice, and mine, of course, took them to Kim, she read them, and she said, yeah, this is really, really good. And then she noticed a few things that would even help develop my mother's voice better, and so I took those tips to heart and started writing from there. So, yeah, I would encourage both writing your own feelings and impressions if you choose this journey, and if you have a chance to interview your mother, your grandmother, your grandfather, or father.
Yeah. Listen. In the book's second chapter, we begin hearing your mother's voice.
Yes.
Ancestral home. And one of the things I was struck by was the way she speaks of the importance of being centered. And that
yes.
centeredness involves a knowledge of family history.
Yes. That is, I think, you know, a lot of times when Chinese and other Asians remember their ancestors, it was unfortunately misportrayed by early Christianity as ancestral worship. It really isn't worship. It's just really acknowledging that there were those who came before you who made life possible, and perhaps prepared the way to make life easier for this generation. And it's really more of a paying of respect and giving gratitude in the way that during Thanksgiving we give gratitude for so many things. During Chinese New Year's especially, one of the gratitudes we give is towards our ancestors.
Hmm. Would you read from that chapter, or read the chapter or an excerpt from it?
Sure, I would love to. This is Introducing My Mother's Voice. It's chapter 2 called Ancestral Home. I was born on May 26, 1928. My parents named me Poi Jen. My name means one who deflects negative events and generates positive outcomes. It means that when misfortune dislodges our family, I am the one who returns us to the center and keeps us centered. I am a direct descendant of the first families who settled in our village 1,000 years ago. Sui Wan is the name of our village, and it is a thriving village to this day. We still have a house there. It has sat empty for 50 years, awaiting our family's return. We are a Chun clan family, and so my maiden name is Chun. Your father was born and raised in a nearby Li clan family before he left for America at the age of 13. Years later, he came back to marry me. We were farmers, and we came from somewhere else in northern China about 1,000 years ago. We are people of the Tang Dynasty. That's why we still call ourselves Tongyan, or as we say in Toisanese, Hongyin, people of the Tang. Our soil was Haosek, rich and wet, for Toisan is in the Pearl River Delta, water so shiny you have to squint to see it. Our village faced a large paddy where we grew rice and other crops for market. All of us helped with farming, even the kids. Together we prepared the fields, fixed the mud walls, planted, fertilized, and harvested. Every family raised their own vegetables in their private garden patch. Cabbage, scallions, bok choy, mustard greens, lettuce, so many vegetables. Fruit trees grew in yards throughout the village, for the weather was hot and moist for most of the year. Oh, so many kinds of fruit trees. Red apples, bananas, plums, peaches, and many, many more.
Mm. Now, every place, of course, every life has its sorrows.
Yes.
What were the sorrows, what were the hard parts of life there in that village?
The hard parts actually started with the Japanese invasion. In 1930s, as you know, Japan became, invaded China, starting in Manchuria, and very quickly swept south and eventually reached Hong Kong and Guangzhou, and surprisingly started to go into the countryside. It was essentially a war of genocide, as we would call it nowadays. They were essentially going after civilians. There's nothing strategic about my mother's village. But one day, I describe in the next chapter called The Butterflies of Death. Again, this is a village that is ancient and old and had absolutely no knowledge of technology. And in fact, when I went there in 83, it barely had its first electric wire, which lit a few lamps, essentially. Mm-hmm. But in 1938... a airplane flew into the village, and there was this woo-woo sound of the propellers, and the kids rushed out to see what it was, and then the adults came out to see what it was. And suddenly they saw these yellow and orange lights coming down the road, and they thought they were butterflies, and the kids ran after them to play with them. But, of course, they were bullet bursts, and immediately many children were killed as well as adults, and later they came to be known as the Butterflies of Death. Mm. That is the sorrows that can hit a village like that. One of the ways my village responded, Cao Wun is a step-aunt of mine, but her entire family got killed, and my mother's mother adopted her as her own child and raised her accordingly. In the way of Toisan villages, there really are no orphans. Everyone celebrates one birthday together as a collective during the Chinese New Year's because everyone makes it together. And there was something very beautiful that I found about that when I talked to my mother. And I saw it reflected in the ways why she had always been so kind to children who were around us, whose parents were working. They were always welcome in our home, and she would always take care of them.
Do you think that's part of the clan sisterhood way of looking at life?
Yes. I think because we're so mobile, we don't make the kind of links that really appreciate anymore what a neighborhood is like, much less a clan. When I talk to people who were raised in the 50s and 40s and to some extent even in most of the cities, they do remember a time when a neighborhood was much more like this, when people watched out for each other and each other's kids, when we would report to each other if something went wrong so the parents could talk to their children about them or punish them or whatever they need to do to set it right. And the clan sisterhood's role in the old village was very much to help keep the village together, to help raise the children together. One of the most beautiful rituals my mother described is something called Red Egg Day. This happens after the 30-day isolation, the postpartum. That last day, the mother herself makes a soup, and she shares this soup with all the women of the village. Men can come too, and they don't, but they often apparently don't stay for the whole thing. And she also dyes a bunch of hard-boiled eggs red color, and the egg symbolizes life because the shell is tough, and red, of course, is blood, and that symbolizes life. And that's sort of given to everybody, and then everyone drinks the soup. But one of the remarkable aspects of this circle is that each woman picks up the newborn and introduces herself and says, "I am so-and-so, you know, I am your auntie." And then she makes comments about the baby, the physiology, the energy level, the way it works. In this way, each person in the circle gives advice on what they see the baby will need help in or their strength and perhaps where they might be led to, whether it's to be a school, to be a farmer, to be a carpenter. And or if the baby has some type of illness that's obvious, they could mention, well, you should feed them this and feed them that because that's what we did to our firstborn and they're fine. And so in this way, the baby acquires 30, 40, or 50 aunties, any one of them which who can step in at any point and be the mother if, unfortunately, the birth mother dies. Mm-hmm. So that was really remarkable, and I described that in a chapter called Red Egg Day.
Yeah. Another thing that I found really interesting is how the clan sisterhood, one of their roles was to resolve disputes. And anytime you have people living together, there's going to be conflict.
Yes.
And so it was the sisterhood that would talk things over.
That's
correct. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was something my mother told me about, and then I observed when I went with her to Toisan in 2000. I came to call it the speaking round and round. It's a situation where someone will walk in and say, "We have a problem," and suddenly everyone's energy would shift. There's an expression we have in Toisanese, it's called ji-ji-ja-ja, ji-ji-ja-ja, which is sort of like aimless gossiping or just chatting. But it would move away from that, and you could feel sort of a more serious air descend upon everyone. And then people would take turns talking. And the first part of the speaking struck me as they would identify what the problem was, and then others would add their information or correct it. And then they would shift to the next stage of talking, which is, well, what do we do? Can we do this? Can we do that? And then again, people would take turns to fashion the solution. And finally, the third phase of the talking was the assignment of tasks, specific things that people would do to help solve the problem, and an agreement to reconvene in a few hours the next day. And when I talked to my mother, this is apparently something they did all the time, whether it was to who would take care of the birth mother, who would fix the levee, who would make a new roof. This is something that they always did. And what I liked about it was that it wasn't something separate. It was like at 2 p.m. at the community room today, we're going to do a speaking round and round on you know, too loud TV noises or something like that. But, you know, it would be like the kids would still be running around. They would be cooking, or someone would rush in mid-delivery and they still had a package to deliver, but they would make the time to participate in this. So it was just something they just sort of did. And, you know, of course, I extrapolated it to make it clearer in the book. But really, it was completely integrated into their daily lives.
Mm. Well, we talked a little bit about 1938 and how hard that was for the village. Three years earlier, your father had left for the U.S.
Yes.
In 1935. Why had he left?
He had been summoned by his own father to come to the United States, and ostensibly it would be, as you would think, my dad's calling me, he's got something set up, and, you know, maybe I'll learn English. I'm the son of a U.S. citizen who'll, you know, do the paper, and I'll be a permanent resident and all that. And all that happened, too. But essentially what my grandfather had done was to summon my father and put him to work at the age of 13 as a houseboy in Marin County, which is a wealthy enclave slightly north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And then every payday, he would come and take his money, his entire paycheck. And that never struck me as being paternal or loving, but really seeing my father as somebody to exploit. And I think it's a consequence. That's why my father is always been a duality to me. On the one hand, he's been this incredibly loving, attentive person who really taught me about America and democracy and the Bill of Rights. He was a New Deal Democrat, and he instilled all these values in me of that government is of, by, and for the people, and that really government is a referee. You know, when the big companies get too crazy, then government steps in to kind of equalize things so that regular people have a shot at some security and steadiness in their lives, so that their kids can go to college and they can own a home. So this is kind of what my dad gave me. But I think because of the way he was treated by his dad and other experiences, it also injured him. And so there was a side of him that was emotionally very abusive. And I throughout the book, that kind of comes up. And there's a chapter where I devote exclusively to him called Bogey's Man, where I really examine this. And I really examine how the violence that was in him would occasionally erupt, you know, in later years, more as emotional abuse rather than anything physical.
Yeah. How has this, writing this memoir, and it's taken you some time to do it, some years to do it.
Yes.
How has it affected the family, your brother, your mother, your father?
My mother and I, well, again, talking about my father and mother, I realized at some point that even with my dad's wonderful influence on me, what I uncovered later in life was that the values of my mother, although she never sat me down and said, here's Toy San Juan and you need to learn about compassion, you know, never did any of that. She just lived her life, and it somehow transmuted into me and I found that these were the things that were my essential character and that really helped me in my work and my relationships professionally and personally. So one choice I made was to write more from her point of view and not so much my dad's. So that created a situation where my mom and I were spending a lot of quality time together, is the word. We'd go out and have something to eat. She loved sitting in my car by water, whether it was the bay or the ocean, and I would just use this low-tech, innocuous Radio Shack, voice-activated tape recorder, and we would just go. And it really brought us a lot closer. And then when she saw how serious I was, because I would come back, for example, with the cheese soups, I would say, well, you said it was this red berry, but what is his name? I have some pictures, or I bought some samples. You know, when she really saw how serious I was, she actually opened up even more. And so that brought us really close together. And there's a lot of triumphs in writing a book. The first is it's finished, the second is it's sold, and the third you actually get some money. Wow, that first check is, you know, really something. And in my case, it wasn't super substantial, but it was certainly significant, and it made a difference for me.
Yeah.
But one of the biggest triumphs was when I had an advanced reader's copy, and I gave it to her. I said, "Mom, this is what the book's going to look like. It's not the final." She just took it and put it in what we would call her heart chakra and just said a prayer for it, gave it a blessing that it would do well, that it would be received. And that was so touching. I could have died that day and never saw a copy of it in any bookstore, and it would have been all worth it. So that's what the book has meant for my mother and I. My dad knew that I was influenced interviewing Mom a lot and not interviewing him. And so I think he was a little confused by it and perhaps felt ignored. Unfortunately, he did pass about 3 years ago, so I'll never be able to show him the final chapter that I wrote about him, explaining what I thought our relationship was. I think he would have appreciated it. My brother, Richard, as you know, is prominent in the book, especially the last third of the book. His attitude is, "I know you have to write about this, and you have my permission, but to me that's the past, and just keep my life private from here on out." So I've come to respect that.
Yeah. I really hope people will read this book, so I will leave Richard in the book.
Yes, yes.
I don't want to reveal too much of
yes.
the story.
Yes. Well, one reviewer said, "You go through the book, and suddenly about two-thirds way through, it becomes this pot boiler." I don't know if you agree with that, but it's...
Yeah, it's pretty intense, and there's also wonderful... part of the book, I think, is what San Francisco was like, what Chinatown was like in those years of the 60s and 70s.
Yes. Yeah, and as you said, it also was San Francisco, because I felt that the changeover in the politics and the violent struggle in Chinatown was really part of the larger picture of how San Francisco was changing. It basically had been a kind of a segregated white-run community. There was the Three Eyes Club, which was the Irish, Italian, and Israelis, who essentially ran the city. And in the 70s and 80s, the alliances we were building were with African-Americans, with Harvey Milk, who was unknown then in the gay community, with even someone like Margot St. James of the Hookers Union, with Hispanics in the Mission community. And we were building alliances to make the city representative of all of its people. And that struggle just went back and forth in the 70s and, you know, and as you know, at times violently. I mean, we had Dan White, who I think was emblematic of the old white power structure, losing politically and acting out by assassinating Harvey Milk and Mayor George Marconi, and would have gone after Feinstein if she had been in her office that day. Apparently, she's now a very senior senator in the U.S. Senate. So it was a very violent time, and it's not even mentioning all the police battles with the Black Panthers and, you know,
yeah.
L.A. and Jonestown. It really was a time of tumult, and although people tend to try to isolate the Chinatown thing as its own weird Chinatown thing, I really don't see it that way. I really see it as part of all of that.
Yeah, it's
and it succeeded. Yeah. I mean, if you look at our city today, it's a brand new city.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is William Poy Lee, author of The Eighth Promise, an American son's tribute to his Toisanese mother. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine. You can join us this afternoon with a question or comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. When our guest's mother left China for the U.S. In the late 1940s with her new husband, she made eight promises to her mother, and the eighth promise was to live with compassion toward all. Among the other promises your mother made to her mother was that she would raise her children to be Chinese.
Yes.
How did your mother manage to keep that promise as you were trying to be, in your words, completely American?
Well, I think one of the ways was she tried to get me to go to Chinese school. In the Chinatown of the 50s and 60s, we had these Chinese language schools. There were about five of them. So typically we would go to what we called American school from, say, 9 to 2:30, and then at about 4 we would go to Chinese school till about 6, 6:30. And so for many years I was able to kind of stave it off because I would say, well, look, you know, I've been told that, and my parents really supported us in this in many wonderful ways, that my job is to get a scholarship to go to college. In order to do that, I really, really have to spend time on my homework. So if I go to Chinese school, then that takes time away, and I've got all these other study topics, and we don't want to lose my chances to college because of Chinese school, do we? And so I was able to kind of keep them off base for a few years. The other thing which I explore in the book is the difference between Choisan Chinese, which is sort of a country Chinese, and with all the marginalization of hillbilly-ish or countrified languages, as well as Cantonese, which is the predominant dialect in the South, in Hong Kong and Guangzhou, and Mandarin, which is the national Chinese language in which most people would study at universities throughout the United States. But Chinese school was in Cantonese, and then in the third year it switched to Mandarin. And in those days, with the bamboo curtain, nobody was going to go back to China, and there was really no need for us to learn Mandarin. So I was kind of able to put it off. But one day she got together with, I guess, the local clan sisters and all the kids who didn't want to go to Chinese school, gathered us up. There were about 9 of us, and between 2 rows of women, they marched us to Chinese school, enrolled us, sat us down, and then they left. So that's how one of the ways she kept me Chinese. And I went to Chinese school for 3 years.
Let's talk with a listener. A listener in Urbana on line 1. Hi.
Hi. I had a roommate at college in the late 1970s for 2 years, and she was Choisan. She was from Chinatown in Boston. And this is so interesting to me because since that time, this is the first time that I've actually heard anything about Choisan, and I've met a lot of Chinese people here in Champaign-Urbana, but I've never heard any of them mention speaking Choisan or being from that region, and I just think it's so interesting. But I used to ask her about her family history, and of course she and her many siblings and her mother and grandparents lived in Chinatown in Boston, and she told me that she was not encouraged to ask questions about the family history, and I thought that was so strange. Is that something that is characteristically Chinese, or do you think it was just idiosyncratic and, you know,
well,
her family?
I think that there is some characteristic truth to it. One of the things that is clear in my book is that my mother, for example, refuses to speak about bad things. It's this, always this forward-looking positiveness. She's not afraid of bad things because she embraces them, puts them in a bear hug, and slowly turns them around, but she refuses to talk about it. So I had to interview a lot of other people. I don't know much about your friend's history, but if it's anything like my mother's history and my dad's history, you know, coming from poor working people, jumping from a deteriorating ancient agrarian civilization and trying to make it in modern America, there must have been a lot of hard times. And perhaps they, too, like my mother, don't like to talk about the hard times.
Yeah, that may be it. But one of the things that was very cute is that we shared this tiny dorm room, and I used to hear her while I was studying, talking to her relatives at home, talking to her mother in Chinese. And that she would get off the phone, and I, you know, one time I said, oh, that sounds so interesting. I wonder, you know, how different your language is from Mandarin. And she said, oh, but I speak it so horribly. All I do is stutter when I talk to them. She was very embarrassed about how bad her Chinese was. But, of course, she was raised in a Chinese-speaking, Choisan-speaking household. And everyone, you know, spoke that. And I did visit her at her home. And, you know, they lived at very close quarters with a lot of kids. And one grew up to be a dentist. One grew up to be a medical doctor. And everyone was extremely highly motivated, even though they lived, you know, in a small apartment with many people sleeping in the same bedroom and everything.
Yeah.
Everyone worked extremely hard.
It's
very interesting.
It is very interesting. And I do examine the differences between the languages in a kind of a riff that I did in one of the chapters where I talk about the Choisanese language. You might find that interesting, and your friend might, too.
Yeah.
There's one of the things that is happening, as you may know, a lot of the early Chinese who came to America were Toisan. We were the people that, you know, left and went all over the world, whether it was Australia, it was Vietnam, even Africa. I've met Toisan people in Venezuela, for crying out loud.
And why is that?
Because we were close to the sea. We are have a tradition of being the rebels of China, the Taiping Rebellion. And in a way, we were kind of our own country. Guangdong is sort of like the Siberia of China, of ancient China. That's where they sent all the losing rebels, the bad magistrates, the errant concubines, all of that. That was a place of exile, although unlike Siberia, it sustains life quite well. And because of that, we were always sort of had more of a, we were more free, if you will, of the imperial binds. In fact, it's said that Toisan people are actually refugees from the decline of the Tang Dynasty, which, as you know, is one of the great dynasties in China of poetry and the Silk Route and the arts. And during the Tang Dynasty, there were Jewish temples along the Silk Route and then Xi'an or Muslim temples, which are still there, except everybody looks Chinese. They just wear this Muslim and Jewish stuff and do what's been done for hundreds of years. So I think that that's why we were all over the world.
Well, thank you. This is so interesting.
Great. Well, I hope you get a couple of copies of my book and get out to your friends. And thank you for calling in.
Okay, sure.
Thanks for the call. Before we have to wrap up this afternoon, or maybe as a way of wrapping up this afternoon, would you read how you close?
Sure. This is called An American Promise, and let me just flip to this page here. Here we are. One recent winter afternoon, my mother paid me the highest compliment. "You cook just like a lady," she said in American. I was puzzled. It was a cold date for a visit, and so I had made her a simple cabbage soup. But she said, "This is a cheese soup." True, I had taken the time to use local ingredients, organic and freshly plucked from the soil, a head of Santa Rosa cabbage, several garden-grown carrots and tomatoes, a fat red onion, and two cloves of garlic with a chunk of home-baked free-range turkey added to sweeten the soup. After I brought the soup to a boil, I had simmered it for 3 hours in the time-honored Toisan way of building the chi fire. In that critical gourmand way of Toisanese clan sisters, Mother remarked on the comforting feeling of the soup's fire clearing her chest. She chuckled at its sweetness, its nutritiousness, asking whether I had used pork to give it such a wonderful body or herbs to make the chi fire. No, I had not. The secret to the chi recipe was not exotic ingredients or ancient techniques. The secret was one I had learned from my mother, the secret of the eighth promise. The most precious ingredient is compassion, the singular appreciation for each person, that ability to see the nui, that is, the child in each one, and thus the desire to make them completely comfortable. I have no children. I am an American, not a citizen of China. But with this soup, I make a promise to my own mother, an American promise, to keep alive the ways of the Toisan, even as I, like my father, continue to find my way on American soil. For Toisan once was only a place, but now it is a state of being, an interior sensibility of home, no matter where I may reside in this world.
Mm-hmm. William Poy Lee, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and for wrapping up with An American Promise.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
William Poy Lee is the author of The Eighth Promise, An American Son's Tribute to His Toisanese Mother. The publisher is Rodale. You'll find our guest, William Poy Lee, on the web at www.theeighthpromise.com.